Welcome to Hope Beyond the Badge, a podcast that brings awareness, inspiration, and conversation together for first responders, families, and others interested in mental well-being and first response. New episodes weekly with your hosts, Jay Bailey and Linda Kokoros. Jay is a father, a military veteran, worked in the fire service for 18 years, and carries a diagnosis of PTSD. Linda is a mom, a wife, a certified life coach for first responders, and a suicide loss survivor of a first responder. Let's talk about it. Our guest on today's podcast is Dan Casey. Dan began his career in law enforcement in 1992. He has worked for departments in Rhode Island and Florida. His experience include working as a patrol officer, in detentions, street crimes, auto theft, domestic violence, homicide, sex crimes, burglary, and currently works as a civilian background investigator. Dan, I'm sure all that experience has led to not only a well-versed understanding of first response, but also first responders and the impact the job can have on a person. We are excited to hear all about your career, all about you, the lessons you've learned along the way, and so much more, I'm sure. If you wouldn't mind first, please, taking a moment to introduce yourself to our audience.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. What a circle it's been. But yeah, like you said, my name is Dan Casey. I grew up in Massachusetts, Easton, East Bridgewater area. I ended up meeting my girlfriend slash wife, and when she graduated college, basically they said to her, she was a nurse, and they said, hey, go south. So we would come down here all the time, down to Hollywood, and that's how we ended up here in this particular area. But I started my career in detention, like it said, in Hollywood Police Department. For a few years, I was trying to get hired as a police officer. I was successful after 3 years. I was fortunate enough to be hired by the same police department. And I was in patrol just for the first 6 years, and then I ended up moving back up to Boston because my mom had Alzheimer's. So, you know, I'm a problem solver. I was big, I'll take care of this. And didn't really happen that way, but I ended up working for another police department in South Kingstown in Rhode Island for about 3 years. And then I got the itch to come back to Florida. So we came back in 04, and I retired from Hollywood back in 04. I'm sorry, from 04 to 2020. So after that 2020, I took a year off basically, and I was bored. So I came back to work as a civilian background investigator, something I had done previously. So more importantly, I have two boys, 26 and a 29-year-old, and I am divorced, but I am happy to say I'm back with the original. And we're not married, but we're back together. So that's my story.
That's just as good as, right?
Good as, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So, Dan, you're trying to start to say, that's my story in a nutshell, but it's not. We're going to dig in. We're going to dig in.
Definitely not.
Yeah, right. We're going to dig in. So tell us a little bit, like, about that, like, you know, up here, right, in Boston. You're from East Bridgewater, right, area, right? And then you met your lovely wife, right, your girlfriend at the time, traveled down to Florida for vacations and decided, hey, this is where we want to be. Why did you want to become a police officer? You said I was trying to become a police officer for a while, and I ended up becoming a police officer for the same department that you were doing detention officer, right? For what does that mean, detention officer? And then okay, leading so, into an officer.
I'll go back a little bit because I didn't always know I wanted to be a police officer. I actually went to school for culinary arts. So big wow, big gasp. Yeah. So I didn't know, but then when we moved down to South Florida here, it's Christine, her brother was a police officer with the same department. So it was really like, he didn't know I wanted to do it, but when I got here, I was like, this is what I want to do. I didn't really know what I want to do in my life. I mean, I did the culinary thing for a while, but when I got here, it's kind of like a light bulb came on. It's like, this is kind of what I want to be. So when he was on vacation or something, I ended up going to take the tests for the swim and the agility and the written. And then when he came back from vacation, I said, I'm thinking about doing this. He goes, I didn't even know. So it was a surprise for him as well as probably a lot of other people that knew me. But anyway, so I ended up getting hired as a detention officer. So he at Hollywood, we had a small jail. So we processed all our own prisoners. So we had 24/7 coverage. As detention officers, I actually had to go to the Corrections Academy. So I was a certified correction officer.
Okay.
But just in the police department, we had cells, and we transported prisoners, stuff like that. So it means to get my foot in the door and to learn the radio, you learn the computer, you learn the guys. I would read arrest reports daily, as many as I could read in a day, to familiarize myself. So by the time I got hired, I was pretty well versed. I wasn't obviously the smartest person, but well versed in some of the what to read, what to write, that kind of stuff. It was excellent. I don't think I would have changed anything. It took me 3 years to get hired as a police officer.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it was a great path for you to sort of start off in that and then, lead into it, right? And sort of get a bit of experience behind you. And it was also a great sort of like tester for you. Is this something that I really want to be doing, especially when you're around those folks all the time, right? At the police department and then becoming a full-time officer. So,
yes, I mean, definitely helped.
Yeah. So when you became, how old were you then when you became like a full-time police officer?
I was 25.
25. So what was that like?
I literally had just gotten married in when I was 24, and then we ended up at 25, we had our first son. So it was really crazy. I was actually in the academy and my son was, only a couple months old. So I had that. It was a little bit stressful, not going to lie, but great support from Chris. She's a nurse. She's been a nurse for 30 plus years, but she basically worked midnights and didn't sleep during the day while I was in the academy. So when I came home, she was like ready to go back to work, but hadn't slept.
Yeah.
So I really, that was one thing that sticks out to me. And I definitely thanked her on graduation day, that the sacrifice that she made, because without that, I wouldn't have been able to go through it.
Wow. Wow. I love that you're saying that already, like right off the bat, right? You recognize that there was support there for you, doing the job that you wanted to be doing, right? Of service for others, for the community where you were living in. You live in the community that you worked in?
I lived just one town away.
One town away?
Yeah. Yeah. Or city. They call them cities here, but they we didn't, you didn't have to, like up there, it's residency kind of, that kind of rules everything.
Yeah.
It's not like that here. Here you can live wherever and work
wherever you want. Okay. So let's get into that now. You're a police officer, right? What did you get into first? You were a patrolman, right? So do you call a patrolman down there?
Yes, I was a patrolman. Yeah,
patrolman
we all
down there.
Out the same way.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so when you became a police officer, that was the first time that you got to carry a gun. You weren't carrying a gun when you were doing detention or corrections.
Well, detention, we actually did carry guns because we transported prisoners to the main jail in Broward County, the jail downtown. So we actually did have, we got certified with that. So I did have that already, which was good. When I first got hired, it's surreal. It really is. It's not, it's not, there's a lot of power there. There's a lot of power to take someone's freedom, to take someone's life, that kind of thing. So definitely a great responsibility.
So tell me a little bit about that. That's a word that, power is not a word that someone says lightly, right? There's a lot of power in that. Share with us how did you feel when you became on the job? Did you feel a responsibility to be that protector on the streets, to be of service? Share with us what that feeling was like for you, like when you became that young officer. Because we've interviewed a lot of police officers, Dan, and, some of them, like I shared with us, okay, I'm ready. I'm new on the job. Let's bring on the cartel. the mafia, we're going to catch some of these big drug dealers and serial killer, all that type of stuff. Was that the feeling like for you or no?
Yeah, I think in your head that you're like, you're invincible, you know, and you're out there and you can do, you know, whatever. You're going to solve everybody's problems and you're just going to have like a, you know, not a cartoon day, but you're going to have that kind of day where you're just solving everybody's biggest problems and you're a hero, you know? So, but in reality, it's not like that 100%. That's how you feel. Yeah. But then you may go to a minor accident and be like, oh, this isn't what I signed up for, you know, but that is what you signed up for. You signed up for A to Z and, you know, one day you might be A, one day you might be Z. So, it was a little, you know, it's not that it was humbling, but you know, you see everybody watches TV and thinks they know, you know, what police work's all about,
right?
Until you go out and do it. So
yeah,
I 100% wouldn't change anything, any experiences that I've had. But yes, I did feel like, I'm driving down the street. I could stop this guy. I could take this guy to jail or, you know, girl or whatever. But yeah. You feel like that invincible, bring on everybody.
Right. And it's such a the excitement in it, right? I would excited. Okay. I'm going to make a difference. I can make a difference here. Right. And, you know, make everyone's world better around them. Right. I'm going to be the fixer.
The fixer is a perfect analogy. Yeah.
The fixer. Yeah. So in reality, right, as you said, you might go to a minor accident and sort of things change. Was there a lot of that over time? Like, we're Hopi on the Badge, right? We talk about mental health and first response. And, you know, as that young patrolman, do you remember, like, certain things, like, sitting with you, like, accidents or maybe going to a call from a, you know, home where there's an infant or a young child involved or a domestic where sort of like you felt with it? I mean, you had a young child, a young baby too, like very earlier on in your career. So was there any of those type of things that might have set with you over time?
Yeah, I definitely remember because my son was 9 months old at the time. So I was still, you know, you're on probation for a year, you know, you can get basically fired for anything your first year.
Yep.
So I remember the beach and a high rise getting a call about a 9 month old that there was an incident with a 9 month old. So I ended up finally getting up to this high rise. And I mean, ultimately the infant passed away at the hospital. So I carried that, you know, not only physically carried that infant, but you know, mentally at the time, my son was 9 months old. So
yeah.
I had, you know, as part of the scene, you have to follow, you know, the parents and the baby to the hospital and figure out what's happening. And cause you have to tell everybody because, you know, that's what happens. So,
yeah.
But at the time, yeah, my son was exactly the same age and, I will never forget that. I could still see myself in that living room. I could see everything about it. And it hung with me. And one thing that I do remember that I thought, you know, you think back and think about the day and how things happened. It was not until the next day where my sergeant, said to me, he said, "Hey, how old's your son?" So I told him he's 9 months old. And he goes, "That's exactly the same age as the baby, right?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "All right, well, I want you to go home."
Wow.
And I said,
"Wow,
I'm going home." He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "I know what you're thinking." And he goes, "I want you to go home for the day." So I look back and I was like, that's pretty important, yeah. You know, because some people don't recognize that. I've definitely been at work millions of times and things have happened. And you don't think like that. You know, you don't think like, "Hey, let's talk to this guy real quick, see what's going on with him. And give him some acknowledgement." And I really appreciate that later on in life for that sergeant to actually, to say that to me, because, you know, when you're going home, you know, the biggest thing in this job is you want to come back home at the end of the night.
Yes.
So to come back the next day to hang out with my son, just kind of putting things in perspective, like, you know, life's very short, you know, turn of a head, an accident happens and you're not around. So, that was very important. That's definitely one that sticks with me till this day.
Yeah. So, yeah, you start to still hold on to it. And I love that sergeant, like, the very next day, and this is early on in your career, right?
Yes.
Like a young, you know, 25, 26-year-old, that probably, you know, in normal, as a civilian, you probably wouldn't have seen, you know, a baby, you know, dead, right? Not being alive, for lack of a better word to be able to describe that, right, for me. But you probably wouldn't have ever experienced that. And you did as a 25, 26-year-old. You know, I mean, that had to be hard, yeah. That was one of your first calls, yeah. And
it was one of the first major calls that I had, yeah.
That sticks with you.
Like you said, you sign up for, and I've said sign up a couple times, but you sign up for whatever, you know, whatever happens. And to see some things, and I've seen it with other officers throughout my whole career, to see things early, early and often, it's eye opening for a lot of people that when you're a civilian and all of a sudden you come into this job and you have to turn it on and off, for lack of better words, and you don't know what you're going to see from day to day. You don't even know how you're going to react to it. You know, you just do your job is what you do.
Can you? I love that you said that, Dan. Can you really turn it on and off though? Can you?
Yeah, I think that you say you can, and then you go out and you don't really have time to, I don't know. It's like Monday morning quarterback. You don't have that time yet to kind of step back and say, hey, I just witnessed, you know, whatever the crime was, or not the crime, but the call was, and guess what? We're busy, and you got to go to the next one. So you don't really have time to really reflect that day in that moment to say, hey, that was pretty horrific. And, but guess what? I'm going to this other thing because we're short staffed, shorthanded, or it's just really busy. Yeah. And I can't, there's nothing else I can do.
Yeah. So, but in that instance, right. I think we can create that time, and that's part of this whole conversation about mental health and first response. What a wonderful story about, you know, the sergeant, your supervisor, giving you that opportunity, and listening to you talk about it, the things that you realized in that moment about your own family and the preciousness of life. It's not at all surprising to me that part of that whole remembrance is that gesture by someone that sounds like a very capable leader who was well ahead of their time, and you get that moment to process. And that's what I hope to see more first responders doing is prioritizing that kind of space between the incident and bringing balance back into their life. I'm wondering how that gesture impacted you as a police officer. Like, did that leave you feeling appreciated? How did that impact you when he said that?
I definitely felt like somebody was paying attention to me specifically and looking out for me. And I would hope that, like you say, more and more supervisors and other officers, for that matter, start. And if they probably are, because you have all this peer support and all that other stuff now. But, look, that's what this is about, is looking out for your fellow officer.
Yeah.
Your fellow dispatcher, or your fellow firefighter, whatever it is to recognize that. Did it change the way I looked at people? That's not something I would have thought about then, but I definitely, when I was on either a squad or whoever, I tried to, you know, care about people, because you get lost in this job. You know, you kind of focus on, I gotta do this. I gotta do that. And this guy's or girl has to do it next to me. So, everybody's just, you know, so focused on the job that you're right. You have to have time to reflect and kind of like look back and say, hey, you know, what did I just witness here?
Yep.
You know, and you got, like you said, there's gotta be that creation of space and time where you just sit and, hey, you know, I had a crazy night. I need to tell somebody about it, because if you keep it in, you know, that's where the problems start.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back 28 years, I mean, you became a full-time police officer in 95. So, you know, when you're going back those 28 years when you were young, right, and, you know, you had a young family, and just reflecting back on that, you know, that accident, right, where the young child and you had a young child at the same time. the police officer who's, you know, said to you, hey, first of all, he took notice, you're young, and usually they don't know anything about each other right yet, especially being new, right? Yeah. But the fact that he took notice that you had a young family and around the same age and knew that, that this is probably going to hit him in a fairly different way. But what also I do notice is that he was definitely, like, I agree with Jay, he was definitely ahead of time, because, you know, even going back 5 or 6 years ago when we lost Alex, those things weren't even said, and still in some places they're not said or asked. So you were very lucky to have that sergeant sort of, you know, show you some grace at that time. I have a question though, just stemming from that. Did you take some of that, like that feeling that you felt from that day, from the officer, you know, showing you some empathy and compassion? Did you try to sort of lead by that yourself if you noticed somebody, you know, in your department that might be struggling or had a few bad calls during the week or whatever it might be? Did you ever find yourself asking that same question?
So I, or similar? You know, with phone technology, the way it is now, if someone was out or something was happening, I try to reach out to people, even if I didn't talk to them all the time or whatever. I would try to be like, hey, you know, you don't, for the text, it doesn't take anything to text somebody.
Yes.
And say, hey, how are you doing? You know, and I just remember if somebody was out or whatever, not that I was, you know, this making grand gestures all the time, but I just think like a text to say, hey, how you doing?
Yeah.
Means so much to, it seems like it's such a small thing, but in the scheme of things, it doesn't take you 5 seconds to shoot out a text. And mm-hmm. and if somebody's not feeling it, they don't have to answer it.
Yeah.
But it's nice to know that somebody's like thinking about it. You know
Absolutely.
What I mean? So, and definitely when the technology was better, I would check in on people a lot. I mean, you're very close to these people. You hang out with these people more than you do your family, with overtime and working, you know, details, extra duty jobs and all kinds of stuff that is your family. And then the first thing everybody says is, hey, everybody want to go out on our day off? And I'm like, okay, but we just hung out for 40 hours. But
yeah,
sure. Let's go hang out.
Yeah.
So we ended up doing a lot of stuff family-wise with other, you know, families in police. And I've heard you guys talk about it, not to, if you're going to ask this later, but that's all you hang out with is people in law enforcement, because, you know, either you have the same days off, obviously you're doing the same job because that's what all conversations come back to. And it's just easy, you know?
Yeah.
If I had to, and I listened to a lot of your shows, if I had to go back, I would keep my original friends closer. Do you know what I mean?
Why? Share with us why.
No, because I think that I reflect on it now that, you know, your friends have been your friends since I've had the same friends since high school from up north. And you kind of forget that a little bit. I would always keep in touch with them, but I wouldn't always be as close as I should have been.
Yes.
So, and whether they, you know, they never said anything to me, but they certainly could have and called me out and said, hey, how come we're not talking? You know, life moves on and you forget about all the stuff. Not that you forget about your friends, but I'm in a different state, but like I said, a phone call is the biggest thing. So
yeah.
I definitely do regret that. And I've never mentioned it to my friends, and maybe they'll listen to this and be like, oh, okay. He did realize.
Yes. And yeah. I think what you're talking about also about, like, you know, the more you get into your career as a first responder in general, it's so easy to get caught up in hanging out with also the people who you work with on a daily basis, especially police officers, right? Because, you know, the stuff you see and the stuff that you do and all of that type of stuff. And then also with some, like, hatred, right? We've heard other police officers talk about, you know, people wouldn't get it, right? Or talking about this type of stuff that you do would be too much for your regular civilian friends, right? So they started to just connect with each other on the job, and Jay would be able to attest to that too, right?
Yeah, yes, ma'am.
Yeah. So I love where this conversation is going. I really, really do. So tell us a little bit then about you got into different, where did you go from being a patrolman, right?
So pretty early on, after I moved back, I think it was 05, that's when I started in the detective bureau. I started just, you know, everybody kind of starts out like auto theft, burglary. I was in auto theft. And then, you know, it's funny in police departments, like you could, not that you can never get comfortable in one job, but there's always something, you can always go somewhere else. So even without thinking about it, people talk about, hey, who do we want to come into this unit if somebody leaves and whatever. So I was in auto theft for probably less than a year. And then I went, somebody left a different unit in domestic violence. So they asked me if I would go over there. So I was like, sure, I'll go over there. And that's basically what would happen every time is like, that's how an opening would happen. You would talk to the sergeant, and the sergeant would talk to you on the side and say, hey, I think you'd be really good over here. What do you think? And so I was in domestic violence for a little while. And then the homicide sergeant got me one day. And it's always because somebody else either didn't want to go in there or it didn't work out or whatever. And that one I had to think about because that was a big jump. My kids were young at the time. And one of my main things was to the sergeant was, I have young kids, like homicides, you know, you're gone for a couple of days at a time. It's no joke. So
yeah.
He goes, well, we all have kids and, we all make it work. So he goes, just let, you know, not rush, but you get to tell me by the end of the day. So of course, you know,
wow.
I ran it by
not rush, but yeah, the end of the day.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, if you're going to do anything in the detective bureau, that's kind of the spot to be in because that's the most, I know it's sad, but it's the most exciting work. But, I went home that night and I asked Chris and she's like, is that what you want to do? And I go, I don't know if I wanted to do it this early, but it's offered to me. So, and she goes, I think you should do it. So I did that. That's a life changer. I think the first weekend I got transferred. We talked about it on a Friday and it was going to happen on a Monday. And I think that Saturday morning, the next morning, literally we had a homicide and I got called out and gone. I was gone from, I don't know, like 8 in the morning till about two in the morning. And they said, go home, get a couple hours sleep and meet us back here at 6 a.m. and did it all over again the next day, which was a Sunday, and then back to work on Monday, regular work. So, and it was like that. I did it for 3 years and there was a couple reasons I left, but one of them was definitely family. I missed a lot of stuff with the boys and I did not like that part. I would miss baseball games and school stuff and I just didn't like it. So I tried to simplify my life and went back to patrol for a little while.
Yeah. I love that you're saying that, you know, you sound like a person that's sort of in touch with, you know, what's going on around you. And as you said, I was missing a lot of, you know, the stuff going on, the kids growing up and sports and that type of stuff. And I wanted to be a part of that because you don't get that back again, right? Because they continue to grow. And I love that you sound really, really in touch with all of that. But out of all of these, you know, different areas that you worked, like auto theft, domestic violence, that had to be hard. You know, sex crimes and homicide. Which one out of all of them that you did that you found that was adventurous and or even was the worst to deal with as far as emotionally dealing with it on the job?
I would say homicide would be the answer. I mean, you don't unsee any of that stuff. You don't forget it. And it's not something normal to go see, you know, I'm not going to get graphic, but I would be home on Sunday with the, you know, with the family or whatever. And my sergeant would call and say, hey, this guy took his own life. Can you just go over there and, you know, go to the call and take care of it. And then, you know, I'm supposed to come back and after seeing that and hang out with the family again, you know, you're like, okay, well, I just saw some really horrific things and, But those kind of things, they stick with you, in my opinion. And I'm only speaking for me.
Yes, they do.
But in the same respect, you know, when you're putting people in jail for those, you know, crimes against those people, it's also a good feeling. But for the homicides, you're kind of like married to the family. You know, you get really close with these families that this stuff happens to. And I can tell you, the probably the nicest letter I ever got was from a family. It was that particular call that I just told you. His brother was the one that passed away, and the brother was in the state of Washington, so I had to call that state and have the police go out there while I told him on the phone. So I said, when you get there, you know, hand him the phone and whatever. And that was probably the nicest letter I ever got from anybody. And that's probably the most I ever did for any families, as far as, you know, I didn't want them to come here and see. That was the first thing that they would see, is the actual scene. So we had the crime scene cleanup come and do all this stuff. And I took the guy's car and had it brought to the station so that nothing would happen to it. But these people, like, there was some law enforcement in that family, really appreciated it. And I think for me, as far as like the rewarding part of the, you know, the homicides and just regular deaths, we would go investigate just regular deaths as well, is speaking to the families and trying to give them, you know, comfort and at least some guidance for the time being.
Yeah.
I think I was, and I'm not tooting my own horn, I just think I was meant for that, as far as like the coordinating with them and speaking with them and anything that they needed at the time. And it was, you know, it was definitely part of the job, depending on how much you wanted to make it part of the job, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah.
So, and it definitely was appreciated by the families, but it was something that was just in me. And it was just like, okay, well, we need to do this, we need to do that. And definitely people need that guidance during that time. So it wasn't unwanted. So
I feel that from you. I definitely feel that from you. What I'm saying in my head when you're talking is saying, if there's someone that has to do that job, right, of offering comfort to the family, and, you know, giving them guidance and offering resources, I can feel that I would want you to be that guy knocking on my door. Does that make sense?
It does. I wouldn't want to knock on your door, but I would.
Yes. I just thought to mean that you would be the type of person that I would want at the door, that type of sort of compassionate person who would just have to relate with you, rather than just going in, this is what's happening, and then out the door and there's no connection, right? You start to make a connection with the family. That's what I mean. And so I'm looking at you through the camera and I'm saying, yeah, if that's a person that's knocking on someone's doors, I would want to be him each time, to offer comfort to a family who's finding out some, you know, their lives are changed forever, right? In some form of way, right?
That's the most important thing that you just said. Their lives have changed forever, so you can make an impact on that person by not even knowing it. You know, if you're one way, you're definitely making an impact. But if you're going to be helpful, which you're supposed to be, it's also, you know, a very, very tough, trying time for people. And it's not, even though it's like semi-normal for us to be doing it, it's not normal for people to be hearing it. So
yes, absolutely. I totally get you. I mean, I'm just sort of, you know, thinking back to the time, like when we found out about Alex, and you know, from the law enforcement part of it, there wasn't that comfort, there wasn't that connection, right? But I do remember who and where and when I did receive that, and I felt that comfort and connection from an individual, right? They just so happened to be police officers at the time, but it wasn't in a formal setting, right? They were off duty officers that were coming in to visit me, and I remember that connection. So even through times of trauma, right, going through our own disbelief and trying to process everything, I remember those conversations very vividly. And I'll be forever grateful for them. So I know from the families that you offered comfort to I'm sure they felt the same way. So thank you, sir, for doing that. And I'm hoping, you know, other people are listening will also be able to pick up on that too, because it is so important. It's just able to help a family be able to move on a little bit and remember that. So I'm going through a struggle, but I remember this person who comforted me. And that's a huge thing, right? That got me through this time. And that is so, so important. It makes a big difference in people's lives for sure. You thinking about that, Jay?
I'm just thinking about the importance of what you're describing. And I was also kind of wondering, after you go through that depth of an experience, that type of emotional exchange with someone through the course of your duties, was there ever any debriefing for you or for officers that were doing that job where they would sort of check in and do like an after action review and see how you were doing?
Yeah.
I would love, perfect world, I'd love to say yes, but yep, at the time I don't remember any of that, you know,
yeah,
being as part of the norm is saying, hey, how's everybody doing? I know you saw this, that, the other thing. I don't remember that.
Okay. Mm. So what did you do, Dan, to be able to, you know, to cope through those times, right? If certain situations or certain calls stuck with you, like just like the previous one in your early days, as you now became more experienced at your job, right? What did you do to be able to cope with those things?
So I was fortunate because Chris is a nurse, so I had that at home. Mm. So, you know, they always say, oh, don't bring your work home and don't, you know, don't talk about it with your family. But she was seeing some crazy stuff too. Yeah. So we kind of, and us growing up together kind of, you know, we would bounce stuff off back and forth to each other about the nature of both of our businesses. So it was very important to definitely talk about that with her. And I'm not saying I talked about it every night, but there was those calls where I'd be like, hey, and we would talk about it, and she would probably do it without even me knowing, dragging it out of me. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
'cause she's just, that's how she is. So, but besides that, I think we talked about it. You don't really deal with it. I don't think there was a really way we dealt with it. You know, I've heard past shows where everybody goes out and, you know, has some drinks or whatever. And I've definitely been one of those people, not to an abuse standpoint, but to blow off some steam or whatever. But I could definitely see where if you're that type of person where you could get caught up quickly,
yeah,
in the substance abuse,
yeah,
to deal with, to try to push stuff down. And because you, like you said before, and sometimes you get a little angry, you know, you're all these emotions are coming out, but you're really not putting it towards anything,
yeah,
which is, you know, that's a dangerous thing in itself.
Yeah. Yeah, it absolutely is, for sure. And yeah, you're sort of describing it in general, right? Not in particularly about yourself, but yeah, a lot of those like first responders, you were very fortunate to be able to have a support system backing you up when you got home. Your wife is a nurse, she deals with trauma all the time. So you were able to sort of bounce those things over when you needed to, right? And as you said, you know, she was probably pulling it out of me without me even knowing, because that's just the way she did things, right? But in hindsight, now you're looking back, that's probably what it was. But yeah, I think that a lot of first responders will go home and a spouse, you know, not in that field or not understanding, just knows those behaviors, knows there's a change, right? There's a change in the person that you were before, or he, she, whoever was before, and it's different, and they're coming home and they're, you know, not talking the way they used to talk, or they're not interacting with the kids, or they're, maybe they're yelling at the kids, as you said, they're angry, or they're yelling at the kids more for really little or no reason, right? You know, and drinking, and probably drinking themselves to sleep to get asleep, to block out whatever the shift was, or what's, you know, just gathering up, boiling up inside of them. And then it becomes a habit, right? It's sort of effective. Those coping mechanisms are effective until they're not. Jay says that a lot, until they're no longer effective. And life starts falling apart, right? So, yeah, it's very interesting. Do you want to chime in on that?
Not on that part, but I can certainly chime in on sort of moving forward in the career. What came after homicide? What was the next duty?
I went back to patrol for a year. I don't even remember what year that was. And I think I may at some point have gone to like a COP unit briefly. I went to personnel like three different times in my career. So that's why the background thing, that's why I do it now. But I went to personnel a couple times in there. And then I ended up back, I was on midnights for a while on patrol. And then I ended up back in the bureau, detective bureau as, a burglary, detective. And then that's when I made the transfer to sex crimes, which that's not a job I really wanted. It's never a job I wanted to do. I was just asked to do it. And I did it, and I just, that wasn't something that was very pleasant because it involved children and I never wanted to do any of that. Mm-hmm. But I did that for a little while, and then I ended up back in patrol. And then that was getting towards the end of my career anyways. I ended up having neck surgery, and I ended up back in personnel doing backgrounds, and I ended up going back on the road from there, not to bore you with the details, but back on the road for a little while. And then my neck was kind of screwed up again. So I ended up going back up to personnel, and I retired out of the police department from personnel.
From personnel. So when Jordan, that time, did you make a move back up to Boston?
That was back in 2001. So I did the move from 2001 to like 04. We were in Boston, but then I ended up job in Rhode Island. So that was the 3 years. And then in 04, I came back to Florida.
Mm. And what was the difference? So you're working in, do you remember back in Rhode Island, working in Rhode Island? What was the difference? What was that like, the difference comparable to Florida and, you know, up north, right? What was the difference like for you? Was it difficult to transition like?
It wasn't really difficult to transition. It was definitely slower pace. And they told me that in the interview. They said, we looked at where you came from, and we're not that busy. You know, you might be bored here. It was basically a bedroom community. It's where URI is down in South Kingstown. So it's a bedroom community. It's, you know, you got beaches, you got all kinds of stuff. But you know, the one thing I have found in law enforcement is the people, they're not all the same, but they're all great people. So when you work with you work with these people family wise, that doesn't change. You know, you still, it might be a different name to it, but the person's the same person. So that part, everybody kind of welcomes you in when you come from another agency or when you come in as a new officer. So that part is great. For me, it was a little financial. It was a little, I missed back in Florida, and selfishly, it was like a pension thing. So, you know, you kind of go where the money is, and I wasn't making the money in Rhode Island that I was going to make in Florida, and my pension wasn't going to be A, B, and C. And I just thought it was a better life at the time. So not really different, just a different pace. Same issues at every police department, I think, but.
Yeah. Can I get into, your wife, Chris? Is it Chris, did you say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Chris, like, get into your wife, because you did mention it earlier on when you introduced yourself. You know, she was a high school sweetheart, right? And then you got into it and you ended up getting married. You moved down to Florida. She's from the Eastern Boston area too?
Yeah, she grew up in East Bridgewater.
Okay, all right.
And then you went to high school together.
You went to high school together. And then you got married. And you were married for a while, right? Had two kids maybe, right?
Two kids, yeah.
And then you ended up getting divorced.
We did.
Yeah. Do you wanna go into that a little bit? Like what happened there? Like that where did that go? Was it the job that
Yeah, I don't know if I can credit one thing for it, but it was definitely I worked a lot. We worked whenever, like I said before, I think we work overtime, you work all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And it was a different time for the city of Hollywood. where there was some referendum and we ended up getting our pay cut and our pension. Like, it was ridiculous. So there was a lot of stress there. You know, my kids went to private school. So, you know, we had all that stressor of the payments of that. And
yeah,
I think there was just a lot going on. It wasn't like any infidelity or anything.
Yeah.
It was just life was just crazy busy. And I don't know. I don't think at that point I was just tolerant of too many things. So, you know, when you're working this job, and I'm not making an excuse, but you just don't put up with anything anymore. So, you know, you go into calls and you're just like, all right, that's not how it's going to be. I'm going to tell you what we're doing. This is what we're going to solve, how we're going to solve the problem for the day. And then we're going to move on. Then I'm going to go to the next call. I'm going to do the same thing. So, and then, but you lose track of what's going on at home. You know, the spillover is not good. So yeah. At that point, I kind of just shut down. I was working way too much. And I kind of just shut down. I was like, you know what? I'm not putting up with anything anymore. Yeah. And that's how I chose to take my ball and kind of go home.
Yeah.
But we split. We didn't talk for a while. And then, you know, I think Chris and I have talked about this, but I don't know if you guys talked about it on the show. You find your person, you know, she's my person. So she's been there for me since high school. And with all the issues that we had at the police department and her job with the nurse and all kinds of stuff. So you realize, hey, you know, this is the one I'm supposed to be with. So we didn't automatically go back together. It took a little while. But we ended up back together, and we had obviously long, long talks about everything. And, we still talk about it. We joke about that we're divorced, you know, now, people will say, oh, that's your wife. I'm like, it's not my wife. Cause we're not married technically. And we both laugh about it. We're like, who would get divorced and then get back together with the same person? Who would do that? But yeah, so I just realized that, you know, she said it, we've talked about that we're the one that we call in that emergency situation. You know what I mean? So that's that's why we're back together.
Yeah. How long was the separation, like divorce, for before you got back?
There was a few years in between there. Mm. I don't even think we talked for like a year and a half.
Okay. Yeah.
So it was a little while. There was a few years. I mean, I was living obviously by myself, but there was a good probably maybe 2 years in between, 2 or 3 years before we got back together. Yeah. And then it was like, got back together, didn't get back together, got back together. And then finally that was it.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like, you know, in that time, it was like, as you said, I'm out on calls, I'm busy, I'm going dealing with that one, that one's over, going to the next one, dealing with that one. And as you said, sort of can also spill over into the home, like those type of things. If there's issues at home or whatever, you know, we're going to, you know, spill that over, and we can sort of bring our job home in that way, not meaning to, right? Also at the same time. And sometimes it doesn't work that way. But yeah, thank you for sharing that. You know, that part of your journey with us, because and it's nice to hear, you know, that there's a reconciliation and that both of you came to, you know, the realization that, you know, as you just said, she's my person, right? Because divorce, you know, first response, divorce is a huge high rate in first response, and that's for, you know, it's understandable because you get shut out, right, and get disconnected from each other. So congratulations on reconciling your marriage and being able to work on it and figuring it out, right?
Thank you.
Not a lot of people get that opportunity, so good for you, sir. So I want to ask you a question. You lost your mom, right? You came back up to Boston and you were looking after your mom and sort of taking on that role of, again, the fixer. That I think that's a personality that you have, right? You play a fixer role. I resonate with that. I have been a fixer for a long time in my household. But then you lost your brother. I want to get into that. And that's how you sort of reached out to me, right? You're down in Florida, but you saw an article in the paper, right, that we were talking about what we do and we were talking about Alex and what we do for first responders, and you reached out to me and you said you resonated with what we were doing. And so share with us a little bit about that, about your brother. You lost your brother.
So in 01, that's when I came back up there for my mom, but things were really crazy family wise. It was like anytime we have that Alzheimer's going on in a family, it kind of rips you apart to see who's going to do what and who, whatever. So that kind of happened early on with us, and we have a pretty extensive family. So I just realized that things were further along than they were, and that I didn't think that I could take care of it all. And then I'm still trying. I have two boys and I, a family, and I just moved back and I'm trying to get myself settled and do all this stuff. I guess I took on too much, and I ended up, I had to get a job. So that's when I got hired for South Kingstown. So I kind of had to move, but I was, about an hour away, not 1500 miles.
Yeah.
That kind of got lost, and I beat myself up about it, about what, that was and what kind of happened. But I had to decide, like, what am I going to do here? I got a family that I have to put food on the table for.
Yeah.
And I have my mom, but I have people that were taking care of her and taking care of it. I just have to figure something out here. So,
yeah.
That's kind of how I dealt with it, right or wrong. And then, back in 04, I literally moved back to Florida in February of 04. And Chris and the boys were still up here because the sale of the house was going to happen. And I had a date that I had to start. So I ended up having to come back and live with her brother for a little while so that I could start working.
Yeah.
And really, it was less than probably 3 weeks. I came home from work, and Chris's brother was like, didn't know how to approach me. And he said, you have to call Chris. And so I called Chris, and she told me what happened with my brother. And my brother growing up had a lot of issues with, like, manic and bipolar and stuff like that. Mm. And he was 4 years older than me. And I just remember being like, 10 to probably 12 is when it all started. He'd go to the doctors, he would do all this stuff, but then, he also wasn't making, whether it was him or not, making his choices, hanging out with these people and doing, probably drinking too early. And that will get me into another thing real quick, but drinking too early and doing whatever he was doing with, the people in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And then on top of it, the mental illness. I wasn't, and when I say this, I'm not saying it to be mean, I wasn't surprised when it happened, because I had seen this growing up, him on going into certain institutions and doing all this stuff, and none of the stuff was really working. So I wasn't really surprised when I got the call. Obviously, you're surprised at the time, but I wasn't surprised that it happened. And that part, I put some blame on myself, because this goes back to the Alzheimer's thing, where he's living with my mom. And he's kind of her caretaker, but the guy can't even take care of himself.
Mm.
So, we're burdening him with, like, hey, just day to day, you're there, make sure mom's eating, taking her medicine, that kind of stuff. And just assuming everything was okay until we had another plan, which we didn't. And then, I guess when it did happen, my mom wasn't there, and my mom was with my sister, and my sister ended up having to go check on him because she wasn't getting a hold of him. And I mean, that's a whole nother trauma in itself, finding someone like that in the house, So,
yeah.
But yeah, I definitely, that lingers with me, till this day, about, the circumstances surrounding it. I'm not saying it wouldn't have happened or it would have happened, had I moved or not moved. But it definitely lingers with me as mm-hmm. part, like, I could have done something differently, because mm-hmm. I left, and to someone that's in crisis, that's probably the worst thing that could happen. And him and I had a like a love-hate relationship growing up. I ended up in college, I ended up getting him a job with me working in a restaurant, and that was probably the closest we had ever been, which I thought was really cool because we were opposite people. Mm. I thought at the time, like, he would go out with Chris and I, we would go to the dog track or whatever. And I was like, oh, this is the brother I wish I had growing up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Cause we didn't always get along. So, so to get back to it, just, I wasn't surprised when it happened. And, you reflect back and think of things you could have done differently, and I can't change any of it. I realize that, mm-hmm. but, I carry some of that.
Yes. So I'm just going to start to reflect a little bit back on it for our listeners who's listening, because, how myself and Dan connected was Dan reached out to me and shared me that, he lost his brother to suicide. He died by suicide, right?
Correct.
And so I just wanted to, make it clear to the listeners out there, regardless of you being a police officer, right, and sort of, I'm sure. Did you feel that in that time of hearing, that your brother had passed and had taken his own life? Did you tend to put on the police officer role of dealing with it, like pushing it down?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. I don't think I separated that at all. I'm not meaning to sound cold, but that's what happens. You kind of get that way in this job, where you're just like, okay, that happened. I never really did anything like went to see anybody about it, like a therapist or anybody about it. But I just remember, coming home and meeting with everybody. And I was definitely fighting with my sister at the time. We started talking again about different stuff, and I feel bad, but I was just kind of like, hey, we're going to do A, B, and C. And, my mom was still around. We just had to tell her that he was sick and passed away. She didn't know what was going on anyways, but to answer your question, I definitely took that role on as police and not Dan, the brother.
Yes. Yeah, and absolutely.
I think it hit me a little while later, a few days later, that that's what I was doing. And I will tell you this, one of the coolest things that happened out of that was I had just left South Kingstown Police Department in February to come back to Hollywood. What was cool was the day of the funeral, somebody said to me, now this is an hour away, somebody said to me, they said, well, who's the police that are outside? So I said, I don't know. Let me go look. And a bunch of guys and girls from South Kingstown Police Department came to Massachusetts from Rhode Island in uniform, in their cars, without me knowing it. And I don't think I told anybody, so I don't know how they found out, but came there to escort the funeral to the church and to the cemetery, and it was phenomenal. Phenomenal. And it made me feel like, oh, okay, that's my family.
Yeah. I was just going to ask it, how did that make you feel? And you just said it made me feel.
It was great because I hadn't got to talk to any of them until after at the cemetery when they had to go back, because it's quite a lengthy day. But I made sure I stopped and thanked and hugged every single one of them. I was probably like 10 or 12 guys and girls that didn't have to go there, but did, and it was very much appreciated. And I definitely sent a letter of my appreciation and my family's appreciation, because I was not expecting that. And it's true. You hear all the stories about the brotherhood and the sisterhood of the job. It's 100% true.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Dan, I heard from in a previous conversation with a police officer. Was it Chief Del Papa, maybe, dealing with suicide in the family, right? And how, he didn't deal with it, right? And very well. And in hindsight, later on, knowing differently now, didn't talk about it either, right? I lost whoever the family member might be. to suicide, and you know, I'm struggling a little bit over that. I'm dealing with that. Do you feel that you hold on to that in a different way because of your police officer role too? Still,
sure,
yeah,
sure,
still. Or do you feel, hey, I'm able, or I'd be able to use this to help others that might be going through a loss of losing somebody?
Yeah, that ultimately would be a great goal, is to help somebody else that's going through the same thing and say, hey, you kind of have to step out of the box here. You're not, you know, officer, whoever.
You're human.
This is, you're human, and this is your family member, and this just happened. So yeah, you could be tough guy, cold, and handle it like you think it should be handled, but you know, we're all human, and you have to take that time to grieve and show all your emotions.
I would love to see you being, you know, stepping into that role a little bit more, because unfortunately a suicide, you know, in first response, right? And then also suicide or mental health, right? Crisis situations is not biased to anybody, right? It's, you know, anybody can go through, you know, challenges and issues and not being able to handle them, and everyone needs support or comfort, right, in some form of way. And that's what sort of brought us together, yeah. Is to be able to make it easier for first responders to be able to talk about what they're seeing and what they're going through, rather than shoving it down and it becoming an issue for them, right? Just being able to load it off time and time again, not just stuffing that backpack down every time, every call that there's something that might be affecting them. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing to sort of be able to get into and sort of using, you know, our own struggles. I can only speak for me. I can't speak for Jay, because it's very different. But for me, you know, for dealing with our own processing of our loss of a family member, and then, you know, never in a million years would I have said I'm going to, you know, do this and help people and talk about it. And no, I mean, there was a lot of shame, but somehow in some way, just very naturally, there was a shift in my thought process behind it, my shift in, I think, because a lot of first responders come in here into the cafe that I work at. And it's sort of like I had an opportunity to be able to sort of talk with some first responders. I'm very fortunate and blessed that a lot of them were coming in and sort of just sharing maybe even a little bit that would give me an inclination that, you know, someone else is struggling too, right? And it made me realize that Alex wasn't the only one, because I did think he was the only one. And there was a lot of shame with that at the beginning, just from being... feeling judged, I suppose, you know. Jay's very different. He was going through his own stuff, but somehow the connection came together, and it was, you know, we found a purpose, a common in the middle, where we both wanted to help first responders who are struggling in different ways. And me, as from a family side, or being able to talk to them, and him sort of, you know, going back to school. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I just, listening to your response, I think it's really normal. And a lot of times we talk about, like, post-traumatic stress as being a normal response or reaction within the human body to abnormal circumstances, right? And sort of, I think the same thing is true for first responders and military personnel or veterans in terms of going operational in a situation like that when it's close. And I imagine you have helped people by being willing to share that story here today.
Yeah.
Because we know what the rates of suicide are in the first response community. I believe there's been 28 already this year, right?
And we're 31.
You know, so that's an awful lot in a short period of time. And you know, we have military veterans that listen to this, or people that have done both those jobs. So there are people that have been near those experiences, and then based on their training, the way that we become conditioned by our duties, by the job, and then we go operational in those moments. And then well, wait a minute, why did I respond with a command presence? Well, because that's normal based on what you do with your day in and out. It's a normal response in that moment. And I think it's very, very helpful for other first responders to hear that somebody else is having that experience too. And it's not a conversation that necessarily comes up, naturally. And that's one of the things, as Linda was just saying, that we try to do. We try to talk about these issues open, honestly, so that other people can know, hey, I'm not alone. There are some sort of picadillos to this job and these careers and the impact that it has on a person, especially with the length of career that you describe and the many different duties that you've had. I do have a question, though. I'm wondering with all the years that you worked in law enforcement, all the different duties from, detention to sex crimes to homicide, when was the first time that you heard about mental health and first response?
Oh, great question.
So that is a great question. And I've listened to a couple of the shows, and I never heard, you didn't really hear about, and I know people have said this, but you didn't hear about getting help.
Yeah.
Like, you heard of EAP, and, Linda and I talked about it when I was up there. And EAP is a couple phone calls, and a lot of hassle with your insurance and whatever. People want immediate response when they call somebody for help. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't change from Joe Schmo to the officer. It's just a little bit more difficult to get the officer to admit that that's what they need.
Yeah.
But I never heard of any of that. I didn't, you bring your car for an oil change every 3,000 miles, but do you go check your head for any, life checkup?
Mm-hmm. You don't. No. Yeah.
You don't. And why? But I never, that's a great question. And I didn't really hear about anything. And that the fact that there is now peer support and all these places to go, it just baffles my mind. We're way behind the curve. Mm. But I think they're trying to make up for it. I don't fault any police department or whatever. I just don't think they knew what to do at the time. And they didn't know the resources out there. And, you have all these big departments that are doing it that filters down to these smaller departments. But that's what resonated with me when I to go back to the Patriot Ledger, when I read that article, and then I started listening to the podcast, and I'm like, wow, these guys and girls are great.
Thank you.
You're just listening, and you're definitely paying attention. I could see that and I could hear it. But to bring someone who normally wouldn't say, you could tell me, I wouldn't have told the story years ago. I would never have told the story. And if people listen to this, know me, they'll be like, oh, I've never heard that story before. Dan, mm-hmm. you never told that. To get it out of somebody is amazing. But to have a format that you guys are doing, which is why I reached out to you, it's amazing for me. And I said it when I was up there, when I walked in, you were holding court right there, right? Remember I said that?
Yeah.
You're holding court right there. And then with a lady, and then the officer from Weymouth came in and we started talking to him. And
yeah,
it's just great that you guys, A, met and B, doing this, because it for someone listening that may be struggling, most importantly, to just have an outlet to even just listen to you guys. It's, for me, it's cathartic just listening to you guys and who you have on. It's amazing to me. And if you had told me, hey, I'm going to listen to this podcast about mental health, I would have told you, no, I don't think so. Mm. I got other things to do.
Yeah.
But now I find myself, I'm like, let me see what Jay and Linda are talking about this week.
Thank you.
And it's cathartic. I'm not saying that, but it is cathartic. So like, people walk and they listen to music and whatever. But when I listen to you guys, I'm like, wow, these guys really know what they're talking about. And it's real life. Like you said, it's real life and genuine.
Every one of them, we don't take for granted. Everyone that is willing to come in and share their story, we know that someone is going to benefit from it, right? And that was the whole deal. If we could help one person, and we started off this and we said, if we could help one person start on a healing journey for themselves or save a life, right, or decide that they want to go and get help, well, then this is worth it. And that was literally the conversation that we had at the beginning. Yeah. And I mean, I know there's so many people that listen in and they get something from it, or they connect with another person who we're interviewing, right? And they go, wow, that person was great. We get so much feedback from it. Yeah. And it's wonderful to hear that. So we know that it's needed, right? It's something that someone wanted to hear. And just to make having this conversation normal, that was the goal, to make having this conversation normal. And how can we have this conversation become normal in first response? Well, by putting it out there on the airwaves to make it easier, right, for them to be able to hear it. And that's what we wanted to do. It just happened. We didn't plan this. It just happened.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. We talk about it. It just happened. And so naturally. So we know we've been guided by somebody up bigger than us, right? Somebody bigger than us is definitely guiding us in the direction, and otherwise we wouldn't be doing it. And I'm very grateful and blessed, and do not take it for granted for 1 minute. Mm-hmm. But I want to ask you a question, sir. If you... were to say to a first responder, just putting it out there to a first responders who are listening, or first responder family who are listening, what knowledge or what bit of advice, I mean, no one likes to get advice from someone, right? But what little bit of would you say to them, to if they were struggling and they're challenging but they're on the fence about going and seeking help for fear of whatever, what would you say to them?
I would say that there's no shame in it. I mean, you're helping yourself, and every choice that you're making is affecting someone. You know, you think about the ultimate, and people think, hey, this is ending whatever I have going on. But it affects so many people, and you don't ever get to tell that person that, hey, the choice that you made here, if you were struggling, you didn't get help, the choice that you made here, you just ruined so much more than if you could have just reached out to someone, lean on your family, lean on a friend, lean on another officer. I mean, we sit car to car all the time, window to window, and that's where you hash out a lot of stuff. And I would just say that forget the stigma. There is no more stigma to your own well-being. I mean, what is that worth to you and your family? It's priceless. So to just reach out and talk to somebody about anything, just to get a conversation started, might be the difference in that person getting the help they need. And there's, like I just said, there's so many resources right now.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yes.
For anybody that, you know, wants it. I mean, the Google's at your disposal.
Yeah.
And with the peer support that all the departments have and all the programs, you can discreetly talk to somebody about getting some help.
Yeah.
And I think before, when I say a long time ago, with the EAP, people thought EAP, that is also discreet. Well, it wasn't. I think people knew like who was going through whatever and having troubles. But I don't think there's any shame in reaching out to talk to somebody and maybe changing the course of the events in life, because I personally think that there's too much to hang on to.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, you know, like for an officer as well, that's after going through a long career, you know, we hear all the time, you know, there's police officers and, you know, firemen that have dedicated their life to their career and then they retire and then struggling with losing part of that identity because they gave so much to it, right? Mm-hmm. And then also really struggling with some of those calls that they never processed at the time, but now have the time to be able to sort of look at those things and having a hard time with it. Mm-hmm. And then they're retired. And then what? Are they getting the support then afterwards, you know, from the department or whatever for peer support? So it's sort of something to sort of really look into. And I'm glad that you said that. There's no shame in it. You're human, you know. And you talked a little bit about stigma. There's no stigma. You know, some people have their own stigma. They put on their own stigma, right? If there's nothing really ashamed of, you know, when a lot of first responders go into that career, they're going in, they're the ones that are, you know, see people at their worst, right? The worst day of their lives, whatever it might be. So I'm not supposed to be the one that is looking for help on the worst day or whatever that I'm going through in my life. So some sort of weakness there that is going with, but that needs to end. That definitely needs to end because it's the only way to sort of drop that is to be talking about it. And we hope that whoever listens gets that message from us, from our hearts coming through the microphone, that we really want that to drop. And you know, there's courage and strength in it. Jay has also said that many times. Oh, yeah. There's courage and strength in that once you do start talking about it. And you realize, wow, I should have looked into that much sooner rather than getting to this point in my life, right?
Yeah.
I think one of the things I think is that when you get into this profession, this job kind of consumes you and you think that this is the most important thing in life. And really life's going on without you if you think this is the most important thing.
Yeah.
That's where I think that the friends and the family kind of slip away a little bit.
Yeah.
But that would be my advice to like a new officer is, you hang on and you pay attention to what's going on in your family and your friends' lives, because you possibly could get lost in this profession. Mm-hmm. And then, like you said, when you retire, some guys, this job is their whole life.
Yeah.
You know, they talk about what's going on in the department. You're there for 40 hours a week. You're working extra. You're so consumed with either trying to get a promotion or trying to get a transfer that this, you know, all you do is talk to other guys that you work with, and you're kind of consumed like this is the most important thing in the world. I mean, it is a very important job and it's very serious, mm-hmm. but your life is also very important and it's passing you by.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think a lot of people forget that. I could definitely look back and say that I was part of that, where everything was, you know, this job was more important than anything I had going on.
Yeah.
And you kind of got to step outside that and just look and say, hey, these are the people that are my loved ones, my family and my friends, and I should be kind of hanging on here a little bit, and I'm not. So that's one thing I would tell somebody. And I heard that, I didn't hear it right away in my career, but I heard it later. And I said, that's a really great piece of advice to tell people, kind of like live within yourself and not outside in this. This job is reality, but you know, you're going home to reality every night. You don't want to miss it.
Yeah. You're going to miss it. Do you hear what he just said? You're going to miss it. So pay attention to those things, because they're the important things. And again, how can you get through that career without the support of your family? Right? You can't. If you're going home at the end of the day, and the other officers or first responders, right, they're going home at the end of the day somewhere, right? But you're going home to this family, and how can they learn how to support you if you're not interacting with them, right? If you're pushing them away, basically, right? So yes, it makes a big, big difference. Oh, Dan, this has been a great conversation, because it just sort of touched all different aspects of it. A young career, you know, seeing, you know, stuff that stuck with you for a while. And you had a great sergeant that helped you through that and resonated with you. And then being able to start to go on to different things that sort of stay with you. And I noticed one change in your demeanor was when you talked about, I can see him looking at me through the camera. I noticed one thing, your facial expression changed when you talked about going into the area of the sex crimes. And your whole demeanor changed when you talked about that. You didn't actually want to even get into it. You didn't even want to talk about it. I didn't like it. I wanted, that wasn't for me. I got over it. And you started to get out of that subject very quickly. And I could see it. So I said, I'm not even going to go touch that, because he wanted to get out of it. And you were very uncomfortable in it. So, and that was one of the things that I started to notice with it. Well, this that really wasn't for him, because I could see that it had affected you in some form of way. But I am so appreciative for you sharing your life with us, you know, up to now. And I know there's, you know, there's many, many different things that you can get into. You know, you're still working for a department down there, right? You're doing as a civilian, right?
Right. Yeah. Where I'm hiring officers and whoever for the police department, civilians and officers.
Yeah. So you do background checks and all that type of stuff. Well, no better man to be able to do that, right? For the same department that you've worked for a long, long time. So that's wonderful. And but like, I think that you are a person that, you know, would reach out to somebody. And if you're still in connected with, you know, police officers in the department, to be able to sort of, you know, fine tune us and say, hey, you doing okay today? And don't be afraid to have that conversation. And that's what we urge other officers, right? If you're doing well, you know, pay attention to those around you who might be looking a bit disheveled coming into work, you know, for a couple of days that wouldn't normally be like that, or who's taking more time off work sick. What's the reason behind that? You know, all of those little type of things. Just keep an eye out for those, and don't be afraid to have a conversation. See something, say something, right? Just might save a life.
Exactly.
Dan, thank you so much for being honest with us tonight. I mean, I'm going to reflect on this conversation, because parts of it got real deep, and I appreciate it. I appreciate these conversations because I know it's going to help someone else. So thank you for coming on to us tonight. And I know this is not going to be the last time that we chat, for sure.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Jay. Thanks, Linda.
After seeing an article in a local Boston area newspaper, Dan reached out to Linda from Florida. Originally from the Easton Bridgewater area, Dan keeps up to date on what's happening on the South Shore. When he reached out to Linda, he shared with her that he had lost his brother to suicide and appreciated what we were doing to bring mental health awareness to first responders and their families. Dan has had a long career in law enforcement. He shared with us those calls that stayed with him, some to this day, and remembers when a sergeant recognized how he might benefit as a first responder and a young father from taking some time to process a call where a baby had passed away, rather than carrying those emotions onto the next call. Dan gave us some insight on a general lack of support early on in his career. He noted the progress that's been made and shared his realization of how lucky he was to have his wife Chris to talk through those hard calls. Dan's a compassionate person. You could feel that through the camera. He gets it. As Linda said, after hearing tragic news, those first few days and weeks are a blur for a first responder's family. It changes their lives forever. Under those circumstances, it's a benefit to have a person like Dan offer the family comfort along with news of a tragedy. If you are a first responder who's struggling now, you don't know where to start, please reach out to one of the Hope Lines. We can guide you to helpful resources. Those numbers are 781-817-3357 or 617-657-9108.
Till next time.
Till next time.